In the break, I was telling the audience how odd it seems to me, as you describe in the book, that there's the Secretary of Defense Gates saying, we don't want this thing. It's too expensive, the F-22. It would probably hurt us in other ways. There's cheaper and better ways, better for our security to do this. Let's don't do it. He calls in the head of Lockheed Martin, says, don't be fighting me on this or else. Lockheed Martin backs off, and still this thing almost passed in Congress.
Well, yes, there are members who are kind of on board. You know, even before Gates made his formal announcement about cutting the plane, Lockheed Martin generated a letter from 44 members of the Senate and 200 members of the House of Representatives saying, you know, we need this thing, you know, for defense, but really we need it for the economy. It's a recession, not the time to be cutting government spending. You know, there's jobs in our states involved. You don't want to be the one who's, you know, sort of tarred with the idea that you've, you know, stopped economic activity in the middle of this recession. So they already had this sort of army of, you know, better than lobbyists, but members of Congress themselves going to bat for them. And so people like Senator Chris Dodd from Connecticut, where the engine was built, Senator Saxby Chambliss from Georgia, where the plane was assembled. They had the Texas delegation because there was some work being done there. So all the sort of major assembly points were the same people who were lobbying in Congress, along with people like the Machinists Union who were involved in some of the production. And so, of course, had issues about jobs for their members. So, you know, it was a true dilemma, you know, given that the economy was not going so well. But the defense budget should not be a jobs program. It really should be about what we need to protect the country. And that was sort of the distortion that was introduced into the process, was this, you know, jobs. We got to keep it for jobs, which, of course, pretty much anything you do with the money will create some sort of jobs, including a tax cut. So it was kind of a, to some degree, a misleading argument.
Is there a case to be made that when it comes to government spending, that defense spending is one of the least productive ways to create jobs as compared to, say, some kind of domestic spending or, as you mentioned, a tax cut?
Well, for things like education or mass transit, there's about two times as many jobs per $1 billion spent. Things like infrastructure investment or weatherizing homes or alternative energy, about 1.5 times. And then a tax cut, about 20% more jobs per $1 billion if you were to, instead of spending it on the plane, just cut taxes. So it's about the least efficient way available to create jobs, which also undermines a bit the argument of the company that, you know, this is going to be a disaster for the economy, and really it would probably be a net gain in terms of overall jobs.
You know, again, to emphasize the bipartisan nature of this influence that Lockheed Martin has, I mean, you had people like John Kerry and Ted Kennedy voting for the F-22, again, because of the jobs in Massachusetts. You know, they're not exactly hawks on defense. And John McCain, probably more important than anyone in stopping the thing, he's not exactly a panty waist when it comes to defense.
No, in fact, this was one of the few cases where McCain and President Obama agreed. You know, they haven't really worked together on too many other issues, but both of them felt like this was a boondoggle. It wasn't needed to defend the country. McCain had a little bit of freedom because it was not majorly produced in his state, whereas people like Barbara Boxer from California, Patty Murray from the state of Washington, other prominent Democrats voted for it, as did Kennedy and Kerry, because of the jobs question.
Tell me, just walk us through it. How does a company like Lockheed Martin get this kind of influence on both sides of the aisle in Congress? I mean, you had Daniel Inouye, who, you know, is known for bringing home the bacon to Hawaii. He gets up and says, there are, you know, there's no jobs in Hawaii. I'm just voting for this sheerly on the issue of national security, which is a bunch of baloney. But what are the tools that Lockheed Martin uses to ingrain itself with Congress, other than, I guess, taking out ads in the home state of the senator or representative and talking about jobs?
Well, they're a big campaign contributor. They're Inouye's biggest contributor. Buck McKeon is the new head of the House Armed Services Committee. They're his biggest contributor. They spend about $12 million every cycle on either lobbying or campaign funding, which is the biggest within the defense industry. They hire people who have had important jobs in the government who can then help them put influence back on their former colleagues. For example, the head of procurement in the Pentagon, who had helped keep the F-22 afloat for many years, the day he retired, went immediately to work on Lockheed Martin's board. They also had people go into the government to do things like be in charge of military space procurement, be in charge of the nuclear weapons complex, work on the National Security Council staff, be in charge of promoting weapons exports to Latin America, where they've had some big sales. So they've become intertwined with the government in many ways. So not only does it affect the Congress, but it also gives them influence with the executive branch. And then finally, they've even worked with think tanks that have promoted systems that they have a stake in and help finance them. So it gives the impression that there's these sort of objective analysts, when in fact they're influenced to some degree by getting money from the company.
Describe for me the kinds of, now you stop short of calling it bribery, I guess, of members of Congress, although I guess, you know, a lot of people would say that the big money they give in campaign contributions could be seen that way. But you do call it bribery and how the company has operated in other nations around the world, regardless of what international law or U.S. law says about these kind of techniques. Give us some examples of that. You describe them in detail in the book.
Well, in the early 70s, Lockheed Martin went for a government bailout because they had messed up a major transport plane, the C-5, and had to eat some of the cost overruns. And then their commercial airliner, the L-1011, was running at a deficit. So they got the loan guarantees, but in order to pay them back, they needed big sales, and they needed them quickly. So they were involved, for example, in an operation in Japan where they sent one of their vice presidents. And within a few days of getting there, first of all, he was working with a former alleged organized crime figure who had served time as a war criminal, who when he was released managed to get influence with not only the Japanese government but Japanese airlines. He was the conduit for bribes of $1.7 million for the prime minister, another $1.7 million for another key government official, payments to the airline executives, payments to members of the parliament. And so basically they spent in the range of $10 to $12 million in bribes. President Nixon spoke up on their behalf, as did the Prime Minister of the UK, which made the engines for the L-1011. They did similar things in the Netherlands, where Prince Bernhard was the conduit. They did things in Italy, where they gave so much money that they couldn't track down which prime minister was getting it because there were several changes in government during the period when Lockheed Martin was paying the money. They did it in Indonesia. They did it in Saudi Arabia. So it became, in the 70s, kind of a routine way of doing business. And there's more sophisticated ways to exert influence over a foreign government. But this was basically just, you know, cash, just sort of straight-out bribery.